Welcome to a podcast of a sermon delivered at the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood in New Jersey. Our congregation is a place where you will find inspiration in the richness of diverse beliefs and the power of community. Detailed information about the Unitarian Society of Ridgewood is available on our website, uuridgewood.org.
This morning we are taking note of two Jewish holidays, the Feast of Passover and Yom HaShoah, the Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust. My remarks this morning will focus on Passover, but I want to tell everyone that there will be a community Yom HaShoah service a week from tonight, May 1st, at Temple Israel in Ridgewood. And all faiths are invited to participate and attend. It's a program of the Interfaith Clergy Council. But now I want to talk a bit about Passover and the story behind Passover. The story of the Exodus from Egypt is at the heart of Passover. And I was thinking about it, how Passover is not the story so much of getting to the promised land, it's the story of leaving slavery and beginning the long trek through the wilderness to the promised land. While there was a period in ancient times when Jews traveled to Jerusalem for the festival, this practice faded after the destruction of the temple and the scattering of the Jewish people into the diaspora, to exile. So Passover is now celebrated wherever Jews live. And while some may be well settled in the diaspora than their ancestors were in the wanderings of 40 years in the wilderness, the Seder still ends with these words: next year in Jerusalem, next year may all be free. The story of Passover, the story behind Passover, is first of all the story of escape from slavery in Egypt. The story in brief, for I'm sure most of you know it, that at some point in history, Jews traveled from their native land and settled in Egypt and became slaves of the Egyptian pharaoh. The population of Jews grew so much that the pharaohs started having babies killed. Moses, the baby, was saved and actually raised in Pharaoh's court. But seeing an overseer abusing a slave, he killed that overseer and fled Egypt and settled far away and became a shepherd and married and raised a family until he was called through a voice in a burning bush to go back to Pharaoh's court and demand freedom for the people. And he and his brother Aaron perform that role together, and 10 plagues, one by one, are called upon the Egyptians in order to force the freedom of the slaves. The plagues of blood, the water turning to blood, of frogs being everywhere, of lice infesting everyone, of wild beasts coming into the city, of livestock being diseased, of boils, of hail, in a place where hail doesn't happen. Locusts eating crops, darkness for 3 days, and finally the death of the firstborn child in every household. And Passover takes its name from the sacrifice of lambs in the Hebrews' home and spreading blood on the lintels so that the angel of death would pass over those homes and not kill the firstborn there. That finally persuades Pharaoh to let Moses and Aaron lead the people away. And then there's the story of the crossing of the Dead Sea, the baking first of unleavened bread because they had to pack so quickly to leave. There's no time to let the bread rise. The crossing of the Red Sea, and then the 40 years in the wilderness. Well, in truth, Passover is likely, according to historians, to be the combination of two holidays that existed before the Exodus. One, a shepherd's festival marked in the springtime with the birth of lambs and sacrifice of lambs. And that may have existed in Egypt. The other, which probably began in Canaan, was a festival of farmers marking the harvest of the wheat. A harvest which also came in the springtime. And these at some point got combined with this story of freedom. Well, the fact that the story is likely in part fiction does not make the story any less true. Truth and historical accuracy need not be the same reality. The story that comes to us is the story of a people fleeing slavery and persecution and achieving the freedom, what? To wander in the desert for 40 years before entering the promised land. Now, as I've heard it expressed by a black preacher, once Moses got the slaves out of Egypt, he had to get Egypt out of the slaves. That is to say, the habits of being in servitude had to be broken and new ways of living found. They had to become a free people before they could enter the promised land. Or at least some rabbinic sources have noted, the generation that had been enslaved had to die before their descendants could live in full freedom. So then there's the story, you know, of the wandering in the wilderness or the desert. The encampment where Moses goes up to Mount Sinai and receives the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, and comes to find that his, with the connivance of his brother Aaron, a golden idol has been made. And the people have drifted away from the worship of the God of Israel who had saved them. And that spins out the battling over that, the continuing to wander, and eventually, when Moses dies, the entering to the promised land. Well, Jews celebrate Passover wherever they live. And it is, at least in the United States, the most celebrated of Jewish holidays. At least 70% of American Jews actually celebrate Passover. The numbers are lower for the other holy days. It is mostly a celebration with family and friends. It is not a celebration at the synagogue or temple. But in all places, it is a festival of freedom and also a festival of springtime. The opening words are from the Song of Solomon quoted in the Passover Haggadah of the beginning of spring, the winter's rains ending, flowers giving their scent to the land, and birds singing. But there's always the hope, wherever it is celebrated, of returning to the promised land. Next year in Jerusalem. And there's always the hope of wider freedom. Next year may all be free. Well, the story behind Passover and Passover itself speaks to non-Jews as well as to Jews. And I can think of at least two reasons. For Christians, there is the knowledge that Jesus was a Jew, and that at least two major incidents, including the Last Supper and crucifixion, but also an earlier episode when Jesus is a youth, are tied to being in Jerusalem for the Passover celebration. That Jesus was, in some way, an observant Jew who, like many rabbis through history, argued the fine points of the law and how they should be applied. Another reason is particular to African Americans, many of whom were taught to be Christians during slavery, made to listen to Christian preaching, and who heard the Exodus story of the flight from slavery as their own story, that someday they would have an exodus from slavery. And indeed, Harriet Tubman, one of the conductors on the Underground Railroad, who, after escaping from slavery herself, made at least 13 trips to bring others to the North to freedom, was called Moses. And then when she served as a scout for the Union Army, was called the General. Fittingly, her portrait will in a few years replace that of the slaveholding President Andrew Jackson on the $20 bill. Well, as it was for the ancient Hebrews, African Americans leaving slavery did not immediately find themselves in the promised land. And indeed, promises made with emancipation and with reconstruction were rarely kept. So even for a goy like me, being a people in the wilderness is a powerful image. The message I take from Passover is that overcoming oppression is as difficult as it is important, and that it's as likely to lead us into the wilderness as to the promised land, that there still is to be more struggle. In fact, at the Leading Edge conference last weekend, Melissa Harris Perry, one of the speakers, who, by the way, had a Black Baptist father and a white Mormon mother, so that when she was introduced as a Unitarian Universalist, said, "Where else could I land?" Melissa Harris Perry says that to this day, and she's now in her 40s, her father sends her a birthday card that says, "The struggle continues." No, the flight from oppression does not solve everything, but it is a step, and maybe just the first step, in a road to true liberation and human fulfillment. As one of the spirituals says, freedom is a constant struggle. But what do I mean by wilderness? Well, I do not mean the ideal voiced by John Muir and the other great conservationists of the wild land, the untouched virgin forests that can refresh our soul if we can but see them. I certainly do not reject that notion. I have backpacked alone into wilderness. It is wonderful to do that. But that is not what wilderness means in this context. It is sort of an in-between space, physically not a very welcoming space, but an in-between space in time as well as place, where individual lives or people live after leaving oppression, but before they can find or create a new and fulfilling life. So by wilderness, I could mean the Lower East Side, packed with Jewish and some non-Jewish residents from Eastern Europe in the last third of the 19th century. I could mean the Upper Midwest and Central Canadian provinces teeming with Scandinavians fleeing poverty in their homelands in that period. I could mean the south side of Chicago, with a wave of poor blacks, generations after emancipation, coming north to work in the growing factories of northern cities. Now, all these people eventually settled into new lives, but it took time, and not all achieved stable lives, nor have all of their descendants. But this being the United States where we live, those of us who are of European ancestry could come here. We had ancestors who could come here, forebears and predecessors, because others displaced the native nations, the native peoples, who did not live in a pure wilderness, but in fact had a well-developed and complex economy and system of nations that traded and communicated with each other. Although the land was very green, supporting a large population and complex societies that all looked like wilderness to the Europeans with their cities and industries. we could come here because they came here before us. But this nation, the United States, was born in slavery and imperialism and grew through genocide. Andrew Jackson was not only a slaveholder, but both a killer and displacer of Native peoples, who were pushed from lands they knew well into their own wilderness farther west. And sadly for African Americans and Native Americans, unlike most waves of white Americans, life in the wilderness in the extreme is still very much real. Now, what I say next will sound a little bit outrageous, but I'll say it. We all live in some way in the wilderness. But for white people, people of European ancestry, that wilderness may be more psychological and cultural and even quite manageable than it is for Indians pushed onto reservations or descendants of slaves unable to accumulate wealth over generations and still the subject of uncontrolled violence and racial prejudice. And I would say that as the child and grandchild of recent immigrants, that where I feel most settled is not amongst the people who have been here for generations, and the place where I grew up had descendants of original European settlers and recent immigrants, and we lived side by side. I find myself at home amongst people who represent the wilderness reality because I learned that from my own parents and grandparents and their mixed experience with immigration. I understand that the downside of white privilege, which I do get by virtue of my skin color, and the acculturation of Anglo-American culture demands the loss of the ethnic and cultural specificity that is rightly the heritage of European immigrants and their descendants. A specificity and cultural richness that is rightly our heritage and a source of full living. At this year's Leading Edge conference last week, several presenters spoke of the impoverishment of being white, since it means giving up a part of who we are and the resulting self consequently being fragile. Not a new idea. Unitarian Universalist theologian Tandeyaka wrote of that 20 years ago in her book, Learning to Be White. So to illustrate this point, one of the first African Americans elected to the city council in Newark, New Jersey, speaking 40 years after that pivotal election in the 1960s, said, having defeated a majority Italian city council to make a majority African American city council, we took power from people who had only recently become white themselves. And the experience of many waves of immigrants, even from Northern Europe, but more especially from Southern Europe, is learning how to be white and be accepted as white. The Irish faced horrible discrimination. Italians faced discrimination. Other Eastern Europeans faced discrimination. And Jews from Eastern Europe faced a lot of discrimination. A more personal example. My Italian grandfather, born in the 1890s, from what we can piece together, because a lot of secrets were kept, seems to have played a low-level role in organized crime in the Bronx. He was also likely a bigamist with an Italian Catholic family in the Bronx and a Jewish family in Miami. But a situation like that in the 1920s and 30s and 40s was one where an immigrant with little English could start. Indeed, it was a great opportunity, since as my grandfather became an adult, was a time when the children of the previous wave of Jewish immigrants who had dominated organized crime were moving into the respectability of middle class and working class jobs. African Americans, however, never got to take over organized crime and use it as a stepping stone to affluence and respectability as some other waves of immigrants did. But beginning in the 1940s, they were able to advance through unionized labor. Once the union started letting black people in. And I'm proud to say my mother was a member of one of the unions that first sought out black people to draw them in the United Electrical Machine. I can never name the union because it changed a couple of times. UE, the United Electrical Workers. They were able to advance through that kind of work, as had Jews and Irish and Scandinavians and Italians before them. But it took a long time because, unlike most of the rest of us, their ancestors arrived not as free people but as slaves. But I don't want to forget that throughout history, throughout the Western world, Jews have been the victims of anti-Semitism. Anglo-Americans, including many Unitarians, could be anti-Semitic and were in the 19th and early 20th century. Some notable exceptions, like John Haynes Holmes in New York City, actively fought anti-Semitism through the first two-thirds of the 20th century until he died in the 1960s at a very old age. He was very close friends with Stephen Wise, one of the leading rabbis in New York City, and they worked together against anti-Semitism, build interfaith relations, and for black civil rights. In the 1920s and 30s, Luke Garner, minister of what was then a large Universalist church in Newark, was a leader against Nazism while most white people couldn't see what was really going on. Most white Europeans couldn't see how dangerous fascism was. Historian Warren Grover describes Luke Garner as a premature anti-fascist for taking a strong stand. Now, Newark, as you may know, was a center of Nazi activity in the 20s and 30s. And the Nazis had summer camps at the Delaware River, West New Jersey. And a few people, like Luke Garner and a Quaker woman whose name I don't remember, were Gentiles who stood up to the Nazis before most Gentiles realized how dangerous they were. And of course, there was a leading organized crime figure in Newark who was Jewish, who also played an active role in breaking up the meetings the Nazis were having. But all these people were working together. Well, being a wilderness people, American Jews had been active already in the labor movement and civil rights even before the Second World War, and continued to be so after the war, and many to this day. And you heard the final letter sent by Ron Hirschman's grandmother to her son in America. The Holocaust was even worse than pictured by the Allies during the war when they finally saw the actual sites and devastations and bodies piled up. So bad that afterward, many nations and politicians, left and right, supported the establishment of the State of Israel as a homeland, a return to the promised land. Gentiles of goodwill around the world recognized, in spite of the anti-Semitism still quite extant in the mid and late 20th century, that Jewish lives mattered. But neither in Israel nor America are Jews or anyone else moved by the Exodus story or the celebration of Passover yet living in the promised land. We mostly live in circumstances much better than those of our ancestors. But we are still all in the wilderness as long as there is rampant inequity, racial prejudice, structural racism, and a situation where people are condemned to intergenerational poverty. We are all still in the wilderness. Whatever our disparate paths, we have a long journey ahead. And we will still be a long time before we get out of the wilderness. So next year in, where? And next year, may all be free. Blessed be. Amen.